I want to continue in volume 4 and pick up in November the 16th, 1900. Here we are dealing with divine love replacing human love in Louisa. This morning after I received communion, Louisa said, "My adorable Jesus made me see my interior, my own interior, all strewn with flowers in the shape of a hut. And he was inside of it, delighting himself completely. Seeing him in that attitude, I said, 'Most sweet Jesus, when will it be that you will take this heart of mine to conform it completely to yours in such a way that I may live from the life of your heart?'" In other words, that she will live with divine love instead of just human love. "While I was saying this, my highest and only good took a lance and opened me at the place corresponding to my heart. And then he pulled it out with his hands. He looked at it thoroughly to see whether it was stripped, or that's stripped of all the ego and the selfishness and sin and all the rest of it, and to see whether it was possessed of those qualities to be able to be inside his most sacred heart." So you can't just ask for this. There is a great deal of preparation that's got to be gone into, and a person has to be truly disposed for this moment so that it can happen. It isn't just wishful thinking. So Louisa said that she too looked at her heart, and to her surprise, she saw impressed on it the cross, the sponge and the crown of thorns, naturally, because she has agreed to suffer the passion frequently for the Lord and for us. "But as I wanted to see the other side and the inside," she said, "it seemed to me swollen as if it could be opened. My beloved Jesus prevented me saying, 'No, I want to mortify you by not letting you see all that I have poured into this heart.'" During our life on earth, we are not allowed to see the work that God has done in us. But I want you to put Ephesians 2:10 there. We are God's work of art. And also Philippians 1:6, that the work that the Lord has begun in us, he will finish if we allow him to finish, which Louisa is doing. So while we're on this side of the divide and on earth, we're not allowed to see what the Lord has done in us, because we could become proud, we could become self-complacent, we could become lazy and not make any further effort. And therefore, we wouldn't achieve the place that the Lord wants us to achieve in heaven. So she continues, "Ah, yes, here inside this heart, there are all the treasures of my graces." It's Jesus who's speaking. "That human nature can arrive at containing." So Louisa is being told she has arrived at the summit of perfection, which is absolutely amazing. It's only 1900 and she has 47 more years to go. It's utterly amazing to me. So he said, "Yes, inside of this heart, there are all the treasures of my graces that human nature can arrive at containing." At that moment, he enclosed it inside his most holy heart. And he said, "Your heart has taken possession within my heart." This is an absolutely extraordinary grace. "And I will give you my love as heart." So here I want you to put Galatians 2:20, "I no longer live, it is Christ who lives in me." So instead of her own heart with all its human emotions and everything, Jesus is replacing that with his divine love, with his agape love. So she will be capable of doing very much more after this than she was before. And drawing near that part, oh, he said, "I will give you my love as heart, and this will give you life." And drawing near that part, he sent three breaths, three, because he does everything in threes, in commemoration of the Blessed Trinity. He sent three breaths containing light, which took the place of my heart. Then he closed the wound, telling me, "Now more than ever, it is appropriate for you to fix yourself in the center of my will, having my love alone as heart." Now notice she was given three breaths, because this is the most incredible gift of the Blessed Trinity that she could receive. And therefore she will be loving with God's own love from now on. "You must not go out of the divine will," he said, "even for an instant, for my love will find its true nourishment in you only if it finds my divine will in you. The summary of the 36 volumes is divine will and divine love. Divine love and divine will are the same person. So if she doesn't have the divine will, she can't have the divine love. If she doesn't have the divine love, she doesn't have the divine will. And that applies to the rest of us as well. So you must not go out of the divine will even for one instant, for my love will find its true nourishment in you only if it finds my will in you. Now you really need to put a ring around the only. And it must find my will in you entirely and completely. So the ifs, the buts, the ands, and my case is different, are all gone. It's all dead. Forget about it. There's only Jesus going to live in this heart. So in it will my love find its contentment and the true and faithful response, which is what he's looking for from us. Then drawing near my mouth, he sent me three more breaths. Notice the Trinitarian thing. And he also poured a most sweet liquor, which inebriated me completely. Then, as though taken by enthusiasm, he said, "See, your heart is in mine." So I want to give you John 14, 20 to 21. You in me and I in you, both completely one. "Your heart is in mine, therefore it is no longer yours." And he kissed me over and over again and made many finesses of love to me. But who can say them all? It is impossible for me to manifest them. Who can say what I felt when I found myself inside of myself? That is back to her own normal self. I can only say that I felt as if I was no longer myself. Now, this is terribly important. She's dead to self and dead to the world. Alive to God. Alive to divine will and divine love. So there's your Galatians 2:20 again. I felt as if I was no longer myself, with no passion, no inclination and no desire, completely immersed in God. She will discover as she goes along that with this gift, concupiscence has been taken away and she has been brought back to the state that Adam was in before the fall. No concupiscence. Why can I say that? There's no passion, there's no inclination and there's no desire for anything just purely human or sinful. So at the place of my heart, I could feel a sensible icy cold compared to the other parts. In other words, an operation had happened in her that was real, and that the old heart that was governing her body was gone. So I want to give you 2 Corinthians 7:15. She's now a whole new creature in Christ. So November the 18th, 1900, we're talking about that union of one's heart with that of Jesus. It makes one pass to the summit of perfection. So 1 Corinthians 6:17 there. Jesus continues to keep my heart inside of his heart, and every now and then he deigns to let me see it making feast as if he had made a great gain. Of course he has, because giving your heart like that and giving your will like that to God is the ultimate sacrifice. In these days, when I find myself outside of myself at the place that corresponds to the heart, instead of the heart, I see the light that blessed Jesus sent me in those three breaths. So the human heart has been removed and the divine love and will has been replacing it. Then this morning on coming, showing me his heart, he told me, my beloved, which one would you like, my heart or yours? If you want mine, you'll have to suffer more. Know, however, that I have done this to make you pass on to yet another state. Now, I thought she'd already arrived at the highest point, but it's only volume four. And the height at which she's at, there's no end to which we can actually grow and improve, because that's what will be going on in heaven, that we will be growing and improving all the time and getting to know God more and more and loving him more and more. So he said, I've done this to make you pass to another state, because when one reaches union, one passes to another state, which is that of consummation. Now, the human correspondence to that is you have the marriage ceremony, which takes place in the church. You celebrate it, but then you have the consummation of the marriage, which is very private and away from the crowds. And it's that consummation that absolutely cements that relationship. So you've moved on to that of consummation. And in order to pass to this state of perfect consummation, the soul needs either my love and my heart in order to live, or her own completely transformed into mine. Now, we either need our hearts transformed into his or replaced by his. Now, he has just replaced hers. Otherwise, she cannot pass on to this state of consummation. And Louisa was all fearful, and she said, my sweet love, my will is no longer mine. It's yours. Do whatever you want. I'll be happy. So after this, she remembered about some difficulties of the confessor, and Jesus, seeing her thoughts, showed her that I were inside a crystal. And this prevented others from seeing what the Lord was operating inside of me. So to put that in very simple language, Jesus showed her that while the confessor was very close and, you know, she wrote things down and all the rest of it, at the same time, God doesn't allow us to pry into the Holy of Holies. And so Louisa is protected from prying eyes, even those that are very close by. And then he added, only in the reflections of light can one know the crystal and what it contains. Now, that's Psalm 39. I've written down 69. It must be 39, verse 9. Lord, in your light we see light. It's the same with you, he said. One who carries the light of faith will touch what I operate with his own hand. If he does not, he will see things in a natural way. Well, we're used to that, aren't we? Some people look at everything only and purely on a natural level, and they cannot perceive the presence or working of God at all. And there are others, because they themselves are spiritual and operating from a spiritual plane, they can register when the Lord is working this way with the person. So November the 20th, 1900, Louisa is now called to a new and even higher life than before. So she's moving in the direction of the great eagle, which is Jesus himself. And he gives her new rules for this new way of life. While I am outside of myself, my adorable Jesus continues to show me my heart inside of his. But so transformed that I can no longer recognize which one is mine and which one is his. That's absolutely amazing. John 15:9, as the Father has loved me, so I have loved you. John 14, verses 20 to 21, you in me and I in you. He has conformed it completely to his own heart. He has impressed on my heart all the insignia of the passion, because she's willing to suffer the crucifixion, making me understand that from the moment of his conception, his heart was conceived with these insignia of the passion. So much so that what he suffered at the end of his life was an outpouring of that which his heart had suffered continuously. And Louisa shows you this in the Christmas novena, that Jesus suffered the passion even in the womb. I seem to see one heart just like the other. I seem to see my beloved Jesus occupied with preparing the place in which he was to put the heart, perfuming it, bejeweling it with many different flowers. Those flowers, of course, are graces and gifts. And while he was doing this, he told me, my beloved, since you must live from my heart from now on, it's appropriate for you to undertake a more perfect way of living. So if we come back to the marriage image again, you have the marriage ceremony, you have the celebration, you have the consummation, but then you have a completely new life. And some of the rules that applied to you when you were single and all the rest of it don't apply anymore. You're in a completely different relationship. So the first rule is perfect. Now, perfect means complete. Perfect conformity to my will. So there's no lapses at all allowed at this particular stage. Because you will only be able to love me perfectly if you love me with my own will. Now, please put an NB beside that a couple of feet tall. We can only love God perfectly with his will. And that's why we have to say to him, I love you with your will on behalf of everyone. Even more, I tell you that by loving me with my own will, you will arrive at loving me and your neighbor with the same way of loving. That means you love them divinely. Now, St. Paul has a message in Romans 13 at the beginning of it. It's around, I won't give you a verse. And he says that we must pay the debts that we owe in love. Okay. But I've given you many times references to love in the scriptures. 1 Corinthians 13, 1 Corinthians 14, 1 Ephesians 3, verses 16 to 21. John 13, 34 to 35. John 15, 9, and so on and so on. There's also the one in Matthew 22 that love is the perfection of the law. So the second rule is profound humility. Now, what Jesus, you have to understand that what Jesus is actually revealing to us is a new level of spirituality. And so what was acceptable and even canonizable in the past is not acceptable now. We've moved on. For example, in the 16th century, the saints there advocated humility, and somebody even wrote a book with 13 degrees of humility. I only read a couple of them. I put it down. And so you had to have all these degrees of humility. Come to the 19th century, you have Saint Therese of Lisieux saying on her deathbed that I have achieved humility of heart. But if you can say I have achieved humility of heart, there is still the ego inside of you able to say that. In the spirituality that the Lord is asking of us, we've got to go way beyond that. Hence this profound humility. And it's only volume 4. He's going to move on to teach us about nothingness. You see, nothingness is way beyond humility. What is there to be humble about when there's nothing there? And so we're being asked to allow ourselves to be lifted up to a level that was literally unimaginable in the past. So profound humility, Jesus said, placing yourself in front of me and of creatures as the last of all. Now, that's exactly what Jesus did in John 13. Verses 1 to 12 and verse 17 at the washing of the feet. He was the Saviour, he was the King, he was the Lord, he was God, and he was down as a servant and a slave at the feet of his own servants. Okay. I also want to give you Mark 10:45, that Jesus was among us as the one who served. The third rule is purity in everything. This is extremely important. It's the in everything that is operative. When I was growing up many moons ago, it seemed that purity had only one reference, and that was purity of the body. It had a connotation to do with sexuality. But in these writings, you'll find that purity has absolutely spread out to cover everything your thinking must be pure, that is, not mixed with worldliness and the speculations of philosophers and all of that kind of stuff, that it is purely the truth and the word of God. That your heart must love purely. In other words, it's not mixed with selfishness and all the rest of it. Your body must be pure, yes, because nothing impure or unholy can enter the presence of God. And for that, I want to give you Isaiah 35. It's the most wonderful. There's about 12 verses in the chapter. And it literally summarizes the gospel. And it says that on the road that the redeemed walk on, nobody unclean can enter into it. Now, the word unclean in the scriptures means unfit for the presence of God. It doesn't mean dirty and I can wash my hands and then I'm clean. It doesn't mean that. So you must be pure in everything. And from volume one, Jesus has been emphasizing purity of motivation as well. That you love God with one motive, that is love. You're not loving him to get anything out of him. Because if we have mixed motives, then it's impure. So I want to give you Matthew 5:8, only the pure in heart see God. So the third rule is purity in everything, because even the slightest fault against purity, both in loving and in operating, it says here, that is in working, is reflected in the heart and the heart remains stained. Therefore, I want purity to be like the dew upon the flowers at the rising of the sun, with its rays reflecting upon them, and it transmutes these little drops into the most precious pearls, such as to enchant people. In the same way, if all your works, thoughts, words, heartbeats, affections, desires and inclinations, you see all the things that have got to be pure? If all of them are adorned with the celestial dew of purity, put an NB beside that, you will weave a sweet enchantment not only for the human eye, but also for the whole of heaven. So purity is absolutely essential. And unfortunately, we're living in a world steeped in sodomy, which is the exact opposite. Number four, obedience. Now, you know, obedience had to come into it because Louisa has been trained to heroic obedience from volume one. For obedience, again, I want to give you 1 Samuel 15, verses 22 to 24, Deuteronomy 28 and John 14, 31. I've given you all of them before many times. So obedience, which must be connected with my will. That's extremely important. It's not obedience to everybody doing anything. It's obedience specifically to God's will and doing it with God's will as well, and in union with Jesus' obedience, so that we can have his infinite merits as we obey. Because if this virtue regards the superiors that I have given to you on earth, my will is obedience which regards me directly. So operating in the divine will, we're actually responding directly to God's will itself, over and above absolutely all human beings. So much so that it can be said that both one and the other are virtues of obedience, with this difference alone, that one regards God and the other regards men. However, both of them have the same value, and one cannot be without the other. Therefore, you must love both one and the other in the same way. Now, that's what Jesus has been saying to Louisa with regard to the priests that are guiding her, that she must regard them as she regards the Lord himself. And then he added, know that from now on, you will live with my heart. That means with his divine love. And you must see things the way my heart does. Now, that is the consummation of perfection, that we will actually see the way God sees. Because for most of us, that only happens in heaven. You must see things the way my heart does, that I may find my satisfactions in you. Therefore, be careful. This is no longer your heart, it's mine. So Louisa is on very delicate ground here because she can wound the heart of Jesus more than anybody else because it is with his heart that she's now loving. November the 22nd, 1900. Jesus puts himself in the place of the heart and tells her what food he wants from her. So this continues on from the last message. My adorable Jesus continues to make himself seen, Louisa says. This morning, after having received communion, I saw him in my interior, as well as our two hearts, so identified with each other as to seem one. That's Christ lives in me. My most sweet Jesus told me today, I have decided to give you back not your heart, but myself in its place. Galatians 2:20, I no longer live, Christ lives in me. That's the exact words. At that moment, I saw Jesus placing himself in that point where the heart is, and from within Jesus, I received respiration, and I felt the beating of his heart. How happy I felt being in this position. Now she's in a completely new position of oneness of will and oneness of heart. This is where people only get to in heaven. After this, Jesus added, since I myself have taken the place of the heart, it's appropriate for you to have food always ready to nourish me. So he's actually there. It's not just some kind of mystical grace. Its actual presence. This food will be my will, and everything through which you will mortify yourself and of which you will deprive yourself, you will do it for love of me. So she's still asked to mortify herself. She's still asked for self-denial, even though she's at this particular level. But who can say all that passed between Jesus and me in my interior, Louisa said. I believe it's better to keep silent because otherwise I feel as if I would ruin it, since my tongue is not well refined to be able to speak of graces so great which the Lord has given to my soul. There's nothing left for me but to thank the Lord who has looked upon a soul so miserable and sinful. That's Louisa's Magnificat, Luke 1:46 to 55. Now, November the 23rd, 1900, we're told that all souls are in Jesus. And we know this from looking at the Passion and all the rest of it. As I was in my usual state, my loving Jesus transported me outside of myself and coming out from within my interior. You're going to hear this all the time in all the rest of the volumes, that Jesus comes out from within her interior because that's where he's living. And she is therefore a living tabernacle. That's 1 Corinthians 3:16. He showed himself so big as to absorb the whole earth within himself. He's showing himself as Pantocrator and Cosmocrator. Both of them are Greek words meaning Lord of the earth and Lord of the universe. Cosmo is the universe. He was so big as to absorb the whole earth within himself, and he spread his magnitude so much that my soul could not find the end of it. Now, this is expressed in Colossians 1:15-20 and in Ephesians 1:3-14. Do read them. You'll understand what's being said here. Louisa said, I felt dissolved in God, and not only myself, but all humanity were dissolved in him. Oh, how unseemly it appeared, what an affront is given to our Lord when we little worms, though living in him, dare to offend him. Oh, if all could see that we are in God. Oh, how careful they would be not to cause him even a shadow of displeasure. Then Jesus became so tall as to absorb the whole of heaven in himself. And so in God himself, I could see everyone, angels and saints. I could hear their singing. I could understand many things about eternal happiness, which, of course, she doesn't have the words to tell us. After this, I saw many rivulets of milk flowing from Jesus. Now, milk is a source of life. And when when infants suck milk from their mother's breast, they're actually absorbing life from her, and all their needs are in that milk. So in the same way, Jesus is feeding Louisa like this. So I want to give you Isaiah 55, verses 1 to 3, come and drink, and John 7, 37 to 39, that those who believe should come and drink, and if they do, out of their own hearts will flow fountains of living water. So I saw many rivulets of milk flowing from Jesus. I drank at those rivulets. And since I was very limited and Jesus was so big and tall as to have no end, either in magnitude or in height. Now, she means greatness and stature and holiness. I could not manage to absorb them all in me. Many of them would flow outside, though remaining in God himself. I felt displeasure. And I would have wanted everyone to run and drink from these rivulets, but so very scarce was the number of the pilgrim souls who would drink. Now, there is the lament that all of this life-giving food is available to us all, but very few people are actually interested. We know this in our own experience as well. Our Lord, too, was displeased by this, and he said to me, "What you see is constrained mercy, which irritates justice more." In other words, they're not allowing me to be merciful. And mercy, as you know, is love given to people who don't deserve it. So if we don't allow him to be merciful, of course, then we open the channel of justice towards ourselves. How can I not make justice when they themselves constrain my mercy within me? And I, Louisa said, taking Jesus' hands, clasped them together, saying, "No, Lord, you cannot make justice. I do not want it. And since I do not want it, neither do you want it, because my will is no longer mine, but yours." Now, there's one clever lady discovering how to really use the divine will against the Lord himself. She says, "Now that we're at this new stage, if I don't want something, you don't want it either, because your will is ruling in me, and your heart is ruling in me, and your love is ruling the earth. So I know I'm expressing your love." She knows exactly how to get around him now. And this is why she'll have more and more and more privation, because Jesus knows that she knows how to get around him. So, "Have you not told me yourself," she said, "that I must live of your will entirely and completely?" My sweet Jesus was disarmed with my words. He became small again. In other words, from being huge, being small again, and enclosed himself in my interior. And I found myself inside of myself. And she's had a very, very good experience of what living with the divine will actually is, and the power of intercession in the divine will. November the 25th, 1900 is about love, the nature of true love. "Since my most sweet Jesus delayed in coming, I was almost afraid he wouldn't come. But then, to my surprise, all of a sudden he came and he told me, 'My beloved, do you want to know when it is that a work is done for one's beloved?' He said, 'When encountering sacrifices, bitterness and pain, it has the power of changing them into sweetness and delight. In fact, this is the nature of true love, to transmute pain into joy and bitterness into sweetness. If one experiences the opposite, it is a sign that it's not true love that's acting. Oh, in how many works they say, 'I do this for God,' but then as soon as they encounter pain or whatever, they draw back. With this, they show that it was not for God that they were doing it. It was for their own interest and for the pleasure that they felt." Notice the impurity of motivation and intention. The impurity is that you weren't doing it fully for God. You were doing it partially for yourself. And then Jesus added, "Generally, it is said that one's own will ruins everything and infects the holiest works. Yet if it is connected with the will of God, There's no other power that can surpass one's own will. Because where there is a will, there is life in working good. And where there is no will, there is death in operating. Or one works with difficulty as though agonizing. So the will is absolutely central. And therefore, if the will is not completely centered on God, the work is diluted in its effectiveness or destroyed completely if you're doing it for yourself. So December the 3rd, 1900, this is a very important revelation about the Blessed Trinity. This morning, as I was outside of myself, I found myself with baby Jesus in my arms. And while I delighted in looking at him, I don't know, but from the same baby, a second came out and in a few instants, a third one, both of them similar to the first, though distinct among themselves. Stupefied in looking at this, I said, "Oh, how one can touch with one's own hand." That's an expression she uses, meaning how you can personally experience the sacrosanct mystery of the Most Holy Trinity, that while you are one, you are also three. It seemed to me that all three of them spoke to me, but as the word came out, it came from a single voice. Now you find the very same thing in Genesis chapter 18, when the three angels come to the oak of Mamre to speak with Abraham and to reveal that he and Sarah are to have a child. There were three angels, but there was only one message, there was only one word, and he realized he was communicating with God. Our nature, this single voice said, is formed of most pure, most simple, communicative love. Now, notice we're getting an illustration of the teachings we've just had. It is most pure. It is most simple. Most simple means there are no complications. It is utterly and completely simple. We find this very difficult because we are complicated. It is most pure, most simple, communicative love. That's not a love that's buried inside of yourself with lovely deep feelings. This is a love that gives to others. And the nature of true love has this as its own. It produces from itself images fully similar to itself in power, goodness and beauty and everything that it contains. So here is God with three images of himself, absolutely identical in power, goodness, everything. And only to give more sublime prominence to our omnipotence, it places the mark of distinction in such a way that melting in love, this nature of ours, which is simple, with no matter at all. Now, anything to do with matter is complicated. Anything to do with spirit is simple. So it's utterly spiritual. So which is simple and utterly spiritual, which might prevent our union, it forms three persons. I may better read that again because I stopped in the middle of it. And only to give more sublime prominence to our omnipotence, it places the mark of distinction in such a way that melting in love, this nature of ours, which is simple, with no matter at all, which might prevent our union, matter would prevent the union, you see, it forms three persons. And returning to melt, it forms one, because love completely unifies. It's true that the nature of true love has this prerogative of producing images fully similar to itself or of assuming the image of the beloved. We see that even in families, that children that are born are literally the image of one or both of their parents. So much so that we joke about it and say, you know, so-and-so has his daddy's nose and somebody else has his mother's chin or whatever. Or they have a likeness which is overall, which is totally amazing. So he continues saying that the second person in redeeming mankind assumed the nature and the image of man and communicated divinity to man. Now, you really need to stop and really think about that. This is utterly amazing. That divine love is so complete, so perfect, so awesome, that when the second person came to redeem us, he assumed our image. And in the image of man, he communicated the divinity to us. That's unbelievable. It's no wonder Jesus wasn't accepted, because the rabbis had taught for centuries that God was so sublime that nothing material could approach him. Hence, they had divided up the temple into three parts. The ordinary people were as far away from the Holy of Holies as they could get them. And then it was only the priests who could come close, but they too were behind a veil. There was three veils actually separating them from the Holy of Holies. And here Jesus came among us, breaking all veils, breaking all barriers. No wonder they rejected him. I want to give you John 3:16. And I want to give you Philippians 2, chapter 6, sorry, verses 6 to 11. While they were saying this, Louisa said, "I could distinguish my beloved Jesus very well, recognizing the image of the human nature in him. And only because of him, I had the confidence to remain in their presence. Otherwise, who would have dared? Ah, yes, it seemed to me that the humanity assumed by Jesus had opened commerce with the creature so as to let her ascend up to the throne of the divinity. It seemed to me that the humanity assumed by Jesus had opened commerce for the creature so as to let her ascend up to the throne of the divinity to be admitted to converse with them and to obtain the deeds of graces." That's a huge sentence. I want to give you Genesis 28 for Jacob's ladder. I want to give you John 1:51, where Jesus said that he was the fulfillment of Jacob's ladder. In other words, all commerce has to go through him, with him, and in him to the Father. I want to give you Hebrews 4:16. He alone is the mediator. And I want to give you Psalm 36, verse 9, that only when he gives us understanding can we understand. Louisa continues, "Oh, what happy moments I enjoyed," she said. "How many things I understood. And in order to describe something, I would have to describe it when my soul is with Jesus, as she seems to be set free from the body. But as I find myself imprisoned again, the darkness of the imprisonment, the distance of my mystical son, the pain of not seeing him render me incapable of describing it and leave me living as though dying." So I want to give you 1 Corinthians 2:9 there, that we don't have the ability to describe what we see. "Yet I am forced to live fastened, imprisoned in this miserable body. Ah, Lord, have compassion for a miserable sinner who lives infirm and imprisoned." Philippians 1:20-24. "Break this wall, the wall of this prison soon," she says, "so that I may fly to you and come back to this body no more." So that's Psalm 55 verses 4 to 8. "Oh, that I had the wings of a dove, I would fly away and be at rest." So December the 23rd, 1900, this is about the divine will. "After going through long days of silence between Blessed Jesus and myself, I felt a void in my interior. This morning on coming, he told me, 'My beloved, what do you want to tell me that you so much yearn to speak to me?' But Louisa, feeling all ashamed, said, 'My sweet Jesus, I want to tell you that I ardently yearn for you and for your holy volition.'" That's Psalm 63. "Even my body cries out for you. And if you concede this to me, you will make me fully content and happy." And he said, "In one word, you have grasped everything. By asking me for what is the greatest thing in heaven and on earth, and I, in this holy volition, yearn and want to conform you more to it." In other words, in asking for the divine will to reign in us. We're asking for the very thing that God yearns to give us, because the only way that humanity can come back to God is with the divine will. And Jesus said, and so my volition may be more sweet and enjoyable to you, he said, place yourself in the circle of my will. We would say fuse. Fuse yourself in the divine will and admire its different qualities by pausing in the sanctity of my volition, also in its goodness, then in its humility, in its beauty, and in the peaceful dwelling that my volition actually produces. Because the divine will is the source of all heaven and all beatitude. In these pausings you will make, you will acquire ever more new and unheard of knowledge about my holy volition. And you will become so bound to and enamoured of the divine will that you'll never go out of it again. This will bring you the highest advantage, because being in my will, you will have no need to fight against your passions, and you'll have no need to be always at arms with them. For while they seem to be dying, they are born again more strong and alive, as we all know in our struggle with passions and everything. But rather, without fighting, without clamour, smoothly they die. That is, if you're in the divine will. Because before the sanctity of my will, passions do not dare to come forward, and they lose life by themselves. And if the soul feels the movement of her passions, it is a sign that she does not make a continuous dwelling in the boundaries of my volition. Now, that is an extremely important point. When we get into struggles with ourselves, we are proving to ourselves that we are not living continuously in the divine will, because if we were, the passions would die down. So it proves that she makes some exits, that's into your own will, some little escapes into our own human will, and is forced to smell the stench of a corrupted nature. On the other hand, if you remain fixed in my will, you will be completely trouble-free. Please underline that about 10 times. If you remain fixed in my will, you will be completely trouble-free. And your only occupation will be loving and being loved by me in return. In other words, you'll have heaven on earth. After this, Louisa said, as I looked at Blessed Jesus, I saw that he had a crown of thorns. I removed it very gently and I placed it upon my own head. He drove it into me and disappeared, and I found myself inside of myself with an ardent desire to remain in his most holy will. Now, that's the thing we have to ask the Lord for, an ardent desire to live continuously in his holy will. So December the 25th, 1900 is about the birth of Jesus and is a very important message. As I was in my usual state, Louisa said, I felt I was going outside of myself. After wandering around, I found myself inside a cave. And I saw the Queen Mother in the act of giving birth to the little baby Jesus. What a wonderful prodigy. It seemed that both mother and son were transmuted into the most pure light. 1 John 1, 5 and Psalm 104, verse 2. But in that light, one could see very well the human nature of Jesus containing the divinity within himself. This is an incredible grace that's given to Louisa. And the human nature was serving as a veil to cover the divinity, just like the bread in the sacred host is a veil covering the divinity of Jesus. In such a way that in tearing the veil of human nature, he was God, while covered by that veil, he was man. Oh, wonderful description there. Here is the prodigy of prodigies, God and man, man and God. without leaving the Father and the Holy Spirit, because true love never separates, he comes to dwell in our midst, John 1:14, taking on human flesh. Now, it seemed to me that mother and son in that most happy instant remained as though spiritualized. That's why I gave you Psalm 104, verse 2. Lord, you are wonderful. You are wrapped in a robe of light. And without the slightest difficulty, Jesus came out of the maternal womb while both of them overflowed with an excess of love. This was what God's intention was. If the human race had never fallen, that every birth would have been like this. In other words, those most pure bodies were transformed into light because God is light. And without the slightest impediment, the light, that's John 8:12 and John 9:3, I think it is. Jesus is the light of the world. So without the slightest impediment, the light, Jesus, came out of the light of the mother, while both one and the other remained whole and intact, returning then to their natural state. A most divine moment. Incredible grace for Louisa to see this. Who can tell the beauty of the little baby who at the moment of his birth transfused also externally the rays of his divinity? Who can tell the beauty of the mother who remained all absorbed in those divine rays? And Saint Joseph, it seemed to me that he was not present at the act of the birth, but remained in another corner of the cave, all engrossed in that profound mystery. And if he did not see with the eyes of his body, he saw very well with the eyes of his soul, because he remained enraptured in sublime ecstasy. Now, in the act in which the little baby came out to the light of day, I would have wanted to fly and take him in my arms, but the angels prevented me, saying that the honour of holding him first belonged to the mother. Then the Most Holy Virgin, as though stirred, returned into herself and from the hands of an angel received her son in her arms. In her ardour of love, she squeezed him so tightly that it seemed she wanted to draw him back into her womb again. Then, wanting to let her ardent love pour out, she placed him at her breast to suckle. In the meantime, I was completely annihilated, waiting to be called so as not to be scolded again by the angels. I find that absolutely fascinating. Then the Queen Mother said to me, "Come, come and take your beloved, and you too enjoy him. Pour out your love with him." And she was saying that as I was saying this, I drew near Mother and she gave him to me into my arms. Who can say my contentment, the kisses, the squeezes, the tendernesses? After I poured myself out a little, I said to him, "My beloved, you have suckled the milk of our mother. Share it with me." I find that absolutely astonishing. I find her daring completely and totally astonishing. But if you go back, you need to meditate on this. I can't go through meditations with you because I'll never finish the readings. But if you go back and realize that on a spiritual plane, the act of the birth of Jesus is continuous, because whatever God does is eternal. And so Louisa, 20 centuries later, is able to actually enter into that as if it was happening at that moment, which it is on a spiritual plane, and that she could claim her part in this mystery because she was the next person after Blessed Mother to live in the divine will. That's why she could make that claim. Nobody else could. Joseph couldn't, because he wasn't at that level. He was the greatest of the Old Testament patriarchs, but that was his position in history. So Louisa asks to share that milk. And Jesus, all condescending, pour part of the milk from his mouth into mine, Louisa said. And then he told me, "My beloved." Now, he's an infant that's just been born and he's talking to Louisa as an adult. That's how you know this is on a completely spiritual plane. My beloved, I was conceived united to suffering. I was born to suffering and I died in suffering. The three nails. And with the three nails with which they crucified me, I nailed the three powers of the soul, which are the intellect, the memory, and the will. I did that of those souls who yearn to love me. Now notice he can't do it to people who don't want him, but for the souls who actually love him, yes, he nailed the three powers of our soul, and we can ask him that this will be completed in each one of us. Of those souls who yearn to love me, keeping them all drawn to myself because sin has rendered them infirm and dispersed from their Creator without any restraint. As he was saying this, he gazed at the world and began to cry over its miseries. And seeing him cry, I said, "Beloved baby, do not sadden with your tears a night so happy for one who loves you. Instead of pouring ourselves out in crying, let us pour ourselves out in singing," she said, because she is celebrating the birth of the Saviour. And as I said this, I began to sing. Jesus was delighted at hearing me sing, and he stopped crying, and he completed my verse. He sang his own verse with a voice so powerful and harmonious that all other voices disappeared at the sound of his voice. That's just absolutely, totally amazing. After this, I prayed to the baby Jesus for my confessor, for those who belong to me, and lastly for everyone, and he seemed all condescending. At that moment, he disappeared from me and I returned inside of myself. Now, you're going to have to read that over a million times, just that the sheer grace of it will come to you. December the 26th, 1900, Louisa is still at the grotto. As I continued to see the baby Jesus, I saw the Queen Mother at one side and Saint Joseph at the other, adoring the divine infant profoundly, as we usually illustrate on our Christmas cards. Being all intent on the child, it seemed to me that the continuous presence of the little baby kept them engrossed in continuous ecstasy. And if they could work, it was a prodigy that the Lord operated in them. Otherwise, they would have remained motionless, unable to attend to any of their external duties. I too did my adoration, and then I found myself inside of myself. So December the 27th, 1900, this is about the immutability of God. This morning I was with a fear about my state that it might not be the Lord that operated within me, with the addition that he was not deigning to come. Then after much waiting, I saw him for just a little. And I expressed my fear to him and he said to me, "My daughter, first of all, in order to put you in this state, there is a concurring of my power." In other words, Louisa couldn't stay in the state she was in, sitting in a bed doing nothing physical for all these years, unless it was a miracle from God. It couldn't happen. He said, "My daughter, first of all, in order to put you in this state of victim soul, confined to a bed, understood, there is the concurring of my power. And then who would have given you the strength and the patience to remain in this state for such a long time, in bed, sitting in bed? Anybody else would go mad. Perseverance alone is a sign that this work is mine, because God alone is not subject to changing. He is immutable. While the devil and the human nature change very often, what they love today, they hate tomorrow, and what they hate today, they love tomorrow, and so on and so on. So we're completely changeable, but he is completely immutable." So I want to finish this section by reading January the 4th, where God speaks about the unhappy state of a soul without God. "After going through most bitter days of privation and of disturbance, I felt a mystical hell inside of me. Without Jesus, all my passions came out into the light, and each one casting its own darkness obscured me in such a way that I no longer knew where I was. How unhappy is the state of a soul without God? She's being allowed to experience this to teach us how important it is. It is enough to say that without God, the soul, while still living, feels hell inside of her. Such was my state, I felt my soul tortured by infernal pain. Who can say what I went through? So as not to make it too long, she said, I'll move on. Then this morning, having received communion, as I was at the summit of my affliction, I felt our Lord move within me. In seeing his image, I wanted to look to see whether it was of wood or alive in flesh. In other words, was it a wooden crucifix or was it real? And yet she's looking at it within herself, so I don't understand. I looked and I saw it was the crucified alive in flesh who was looking at me and who told me, if my image within you was made of wood, the love would be only imaginary. It would only be apparent. But only true and sincere love united to mortification makes me be reborn, alive, crucified in the heart of the one who loves me. So here's Jesus calming the storm. But he's also telling us, of course, that a person who has lost him in mortal sin needs to come back with mortification and self-denial and really seeking him in order to come back and find him. On seeing the Lord, I would have wanted to withdraw from his presence, so bad did I see myself. But he continued saying, where would you want to go? Because after all, she has arrived at living in his divine will and in his heart. I am light. That's 1 John 1:5 and 1 John 2:6. And wherever you go, my light invests you everywhere. At the presence of Jesus, at his light, at his voice, my passions disappeared. Psalm 36, verse 9. And I myself don't know where they went. I remained like a little girl and I returned inside of myself completely changed. May everything be for the glory of God and the good of my soul. So she's had an experience which is very important for the rest of us, because she has already arrived at this extraordinary height that she is living from the will and from the love of God, which just means, as far as I'm concerned, she's arrived. And so it would appear that it would be impossible that she could ever come back to experience a lower state. And the Lord allowed her to experience a lower state to warn us, because it's we who need the warning that we can slip out of the divine will rather easily and find our passions waiting for us, and find concupiscence waiting for us, and find sin waiting for us. And we have got to go down the route of mortification, self-denial, seeking God to find him again.